So I began teaching in a somewhat more formal way about 4 or 5 years ago, and therefore I consider myself a beginner. And I've noticed, being a beginner and observing this process of teaching, something kind of clarifying or gelling. And it's said that every Zen teacher has their own unique approach, their own style. It's just like anything. It'd be true of every nurse, every doctor, every lawyer, every accountant. But I think there's something particularly unique about coming from this deep space that we've all just been in, and how it gets expressed in words, which is a very difficult thing. This deep space that we're going to kind of begins to, and then hopefully really deeply, leaves words behind. So the strange task for someone helping others in this sphere, in a teaching role, is to communicate with words this space that leaves words behind. It's not easy, and it seems to gel in a unique way for each person. So, for example, these talks, I don't prepare them very much, and I don't really know exactly how they're going to come out. But if I observe over a period of time, I notice a certain theme to it. Sometimes I almost feel like I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but in fact, that's an aspect of teaching Zen, is saying the same thing over and over again. But it's heard in a slightly different way. It filters down in a slightly different way. It gradually goes deeper and deeper and deeper. So what's gelled for me over this past 4 years or so is defining this process of Zen practice, and specifically Zazen, and what it is and how you do it, and where it's leading you, where it's leading one. And as I've said before, because this is going to be a repetitive talk, as they all are, there's this sort of first step, first stage. I taught someone tonight who had never done Zazen before how to do Zazen. And the way we teach Zazen to people who are new to it is to emphasize the posture, the tautness of it, which entrains the mind in a taut way as well. Because, as I've always said, this is not a soporific style of meditation, going to one center. I describe it more as a plunging into the present moment with all alertness, even enhanced alertness, all your senses working. So this first step in the practice is the step that encompasses everything else and runs through your practice from beginning to end. And is this step of concentration, and something that I defined for the newer student tonight, something called Joriki, J-O-R-I-K-I, Japanese word, meaning a kind of power that develops in the hara, which is where we put our mind's eye. Now, if you were beginning tonight doing Zazen, you would learn how to put your mind's eye in your mudra, centered around your hara, and let everything settle from there and come from there, as you hold your mind on one point. Now, if you were sitting for 40 years, you would be doing exactly the same thing. This is a very essential step in our practice, the ability to focus the mind, to pull it out of what the ordinary human endeavor is, which is to name things, give them meaning, relate to them in a personal way that gives them various importances and valences, and in essence creates three types of things. Things that you want, things that you don't want, and things that you ignore. So-called three poisons in Buddhism. Things that you want that fit your template of how it ought to be right now. Things that you don't want that clash with that template. And these are all very important because it's all part of survival. You certainly don't want to eat bad food. You certainly want to get fresh air and sunshine. And things that you ignore because you can't possibly attend to everything, and so certain things have to drop off. I say sometimes that for me to put something into my memory, I have to drop something else off the hard drive because I'm 63 now and the hard drive's full. So certain things that we ignore. So in our Zazen, however, we leave this entire endeavor behind. We focus the mind. We use it in a way that we do use in our ordinary life, but we bring it to the nth degree. We make it very purified. And we do it from our heart. So we develop this jodaki and this focus and concentration. So you might think that if you were to define Zen practice, the biggest circle that you could draw around it, and what's outside the circle would be the ordinary world of maps and plans and the virtual world of things having importances and meanings, etc., etc., all of which is important, but is not particularly this practice. So if you were to draw a circle, this outer circle would be this concentration and jodaki, bringing you to the very next critical step, sort of a circle drawn inside. So as we start to go inward, the direction in this Zazen is inward in this stage, we then come to a very clear apperception of what's actually going on. Now, what's going on may be just the count, 1, 2, 3, or following the breath, the actual sensation of the breath, or shikantaza, which is the flow of the present moment, which includes, in all of these three things, and the fourth would be the koan practice, where you hold a question in your mind, and I'll read a koan during this talk, that you profoundly question, you go into the heart of this story, trying to understand the very depth, the essence of it. What did the teacher mean when he said that word, that statement? So all of these things are becoming sharply highlighted in your mind. Now this includes your thoughts, your emotions, your feelings, all these things that are operating because we are human beings and we have a mind and a body. And this next step is to clearly get it, that the moment something appears in your awareness, all the karmic causes and conditions that led to its particular unique configuration are done. Therefore, in this space, now I'm inside this circle of focus and jodaki. Now I'm coming inside this space of what I call dispassion. If it's done and dusted, as I said last week, I don't need to do anything about it. I don't need to react to it. So I'm beginning to peel off of the raw reality I'm experiencing in the depth of my Zazen, what can be called all the multitude of dharmas with a small d, meaning every little factoid of experience. If I begin to let go of their meaning, their valence, how they fit in a template, in a map, then I can begin to see them just as they are, and I no longer need to react with holding on to them, clinging to them, fighting them, rejecting them, or pushing away or ignoring them. I can simply allow them their moment in the sunshine of my awareness, and this is a critical second step. This critical step that requires that first step of focus and jodaki. Focus because you have to clear space to do this practice. And jodaki because you need this strange, mysterious healing energy to begin to drop away the old habit patterns that are so dysfunctional and painful. So this naturally occurs. It's some mysterious force in Zazen. As I've said before, there's nothing magical about it, but it's mysterious, because we can't really explain it. We don't know what it is exactly, but we can feel it, we can experience it. So this next step is this dispassion. Now the dispassion enables us to go to this third step, which would be even inside. Remember now, we're going deeper and deeper into the center of our experience. So when we begin to become dispassionate and very alertly aware, very mindful of all the dharmas passing in front of the mind's eye, and hopefully as we do this practice, it becomes purified, it's just the practice, just the breath, just the breath. The thoughts start to drop away because they're not necessary anymore. They're irrelevant. My ideas about what's passing in front of my mind's eye are becoming irrelevant because I've peeled all the meaning off. I've started seeing that the way it is right now is the end result of all the causes and conditions throughout the fabric of space and time that led to this particular configuration of dharmas. And therefore, there's nothing I need to do about it. Just open up the space in my awareness for it to be. And as I enter this deeper and deeper place of clarity and non-opposition and dispassion, I begin to see something shining from each thing. Shining. What is that? It has no particular form, no particular sound, no particular color. I can call it being. The fact of this thing. It's sheer fact. What a mysterious, mind-blowing, incredible thing. As Paul Tillich, a Catholic philosopher, wrote in a book I read many, many years ago, I don't remember the name of the book. He said, the most profound question I could ever ask myself is, why is there something rather than nothing at all? Why is there something rather than nothing at all? We begin to enter this truth of something, of being, of fact, the sheer fact of this Dharma in the space of my consciousness that I'm no longer naming or reacting to, no longer holding on to or pushing away. I'm becoming its flow in a sense, and I'm very entrained upon its essence, which is its presence. And I can begin to enter that and find out what exactly it is. I can see how totally intimate it is. This is that third step, that tightly drawn inner circle, entering into the almost infinite intimacy of this presence. For anything to be, it must be in the center of my being, or I would not know it. And if I didn't know it, it would not be. And as I've said so many times before, this quote from the 6th Zen patriarch, Wenum, he said, from the very beginning, not a single thing has ever existed. Not a single thing has ever existed, stood outside me. Not a single thing has ever stood outside my mind. Even if it appears to, it could not be without my knowing, and my knowing occurs in this center, which I am gradually entering in this practice. This is that deep penetrating Zazen. Now when we go very deep into this, we begin to enter states called Dhyana, and if we go even deeper than Dhyana, which is a highly focused state of absorption. It is actually what the word Zen means. Zen came from dhyana, which was translated in Chinese as it came from India to China, to Chan, and then to Japan, Zen. And Zen stuck here in the West. Because the original teachers of this practice came from Japan and the United States. We hung on to this very simple and kind of sexy word, Zen, three letters. It means this space, this intimate, central. So I'm penetrating deeper and deeper into the actuality of each moment of my zazen. As all the meanings drop off, as any resistance drops away, as any desire to hold anything in place drops away, and I begin to notice this shining from each thing, this presence, and then notice that this presence could not be without my knowing. And then looking profoundly into the knowing, which is going to the most intimate center of my mind. Okay? This is that state of, in Zazen, as we penetrate even further, we call it a state of darkness. It's very puzzling. It's darkness. Sometimes they use poetic terms about it. They say the grand round mirror of wisdom is black as pitch. They describe it as the bottom of the black lacquer bucket. The beautiful poem of the first rank of Tozan, which is this stage, okay? So I'm talking about these four steps, and I'm on the third step as I have been observing this gelling of my particular approach to teaching this over the past 4 or 5 years. This third step actually corresponds to the first rank of Tozan. So the poem goes like this. In the third watch of the night, before the moon appears, no wonder when we meet there's no recognition. It's just like entering a deep, deep darkness, but immensely intimate, silent. And as we enter more deeply into this, we can actually enter a state called samadhi. Samadhi. It's like a stoppage of everything. The world stops, the mind stops, time stops. It's like we're entering the state of the singularity that came before the Big Bang, whose essence and substance, although it's spread out at the time of the Big Bang and through cause and effect and natural law, created everything here, right now in this room, and inside me, and every thought in my mind, every sensation, every feeling, everything that's ever happened. The substance of that singularity is this silent being, and it never changed. It permeates everything. And I enter that in my samadhi. I enter it. This is not an easy state to enter because of the habit patterns and tendencies of the mind that keep pulling us back into naming and reacting, and all the habitual machinations of the human brain. So it takes time, and it takes patience, and it takes a kind of faith, and it takes knowing the direction to move, which is exactly why I'm saying these things to all of you. Only to point to direction. I cannot recreate the experience for any of you, but there's no need to do it because you are totally capable of doing it for yourself. But it is important, I think, because rather than reinvent the wheel, why don't we all benefit from this 2,500 years of Buddhism and how it's came to the present moment and what I learned from my teacher and he learned from his teacher and she learned from her teacher all the way back to the beginning of the Buddha and his enlightenment. So I'm just here passing it along to all of you. So this is a direction. So this is that central, profound entering into the stark actuality, fact of each thing. Because I'm no longer contending and fighting and reacting and holding on to anything in particular. So all of that stuff becomes irrelevant, which liberates tremendous attentiveness energy to enter into the sheer fact, as Paul Tillich said, why is there something rather than nothing at all? I'm entering into the somethingness, which at the same time, because it has no particular color, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, this factness has no particular aspects like that. In Zen, it's called mu, or nothingness. Not nothing, nothingness, the condition of what one might call no thing, no thing. This is that central point. Now, this is not enough. This is not a resting point in Zen. But we need to continually go here. We need to really clarify it. We need to go deeply into it and really get comfortable with it, familiar with it. We need to overcome the fear of entering it, because there is a fear of entering it. Matter of fact, it's a very, very intense barrier for many people, even to begin to look inside. It's extremely fearful and anxiety-provoking for the average human being who is not trained in Zazen and doesn't have faith that this practice will lead to something deeply healing. If someone's alone, they immediately want to distract themselves. They've got to think about something, turn on the TV, multitask, read, talk to somebody, call someone, get together with people, drink a beer. All these things that we're all familiar with. We're human beings too. This fear of aloneness, it's a profound fear in the human being. The fear of aloneness, the pain of loneliness. But in our practice, we enter the center of it with all alertness. We're not afraid of it because we are becoming familiar with it. We see its profound healing potential. We see how it releases us from so many habitual reactivities and suffering actions of mind and body because of these blind maps layered on the innocent world that then we feel we need to react to, defend, contend with. Now, if we stop there, we haven't gotten there. That is not what awakening is. You might call it a very early state when you enter the samadhi. You see the purity of what would be called mind with a capital M. That is a kind of awakening, but it's not a full awakening. It's very partial. It's what someone might call a one-sided awakening. And it can lead to an attachment, wanting to retreat into this quiet, comfortable, dark place where there's no opposition, no stress. There's a wonderful feeling in the mind and body, this sense of shamatha, this joyful peacefulness. Sometimes in sesshin, when we sit for many, many sittings in a row and several days in a row, all in silence, we begin to slip into this shamatha state. It's a little more difficult in everyday life to get into that state in your zazen. But when you enter this state, it's just such a pure, delightful, wonderful state. It has a honey-like taste, and you're loath to leave it. You want to enter and just go back to it, and just stay there. So, Zen masters have warned about this throughout the ages. They describe someone who stays stuck there as someone doing, perhaps, dead sitting. They describe this person as the person keeping watch over the corpse in the coffin. Okay, with very colorful phrases. The koan that I'm going to read you now is they describe the state as sitting on the top of a 100-foot-high pole. You've left everything below, all the dirty world, all the activities and struggles and strife and stresses. All they're way, way below. You can barely hear or see them. And you're just alone in this one-pointed essence of mind. Okay. So I'm going to read you this koan. To describe now, and as I said before, when I start out saying that, I've noticed something kind of gelling in the way that I'm pointing this practice out to folks. This fourth step, okay, so the first step was this focus in Jodaki. The second step was dispassion. Letting all the meanings drop away, all the reactivity drop away, realizing everything's done and dusted, therefore I don't need to react to it in this zazen space. In the everyday world I do because I have to survive. But I come here to bring balance to that, to not have that be so top-heavy and one-sided. I bring my mind down from between my eyes and my head to my heart and enter this third stage of profound, deep, nothingness, essence of mind, intimate knowing, which is at the very same time the being of each object as it presents. Its being is my knowing. As I wrote one chapter in the book that I wrote, no equals, K-N-O-W equals M. No equals M. No and M are the same thing in this place. But this fourth step, this is taking the leap off the top of the 100-foot pole. So I'm going to read you this koan as a way of describing this critical, critical fourth step, so that you don't end up falling to the trap of what one might call one-sided enlightenment. So this is from the collection called the Mumon Khan, or the Gateless Gate, which is the first traditional collection of 48 koan that most schools of Zen, certainly this school of Zen that I was trained in, utilizes after your breakthrough koan. So your first breakthrough koan might be, if it's mu or hu or whatever it may be, or spontaneous awakening. We then enter the treasury of this movement, kind of go one by one through these. So I'm going to read this from a particular book by Katsuki Sekida. I'm going to read you his commentary, which is not traditional part of the commentary. He's a Japanese master. I think he died a year or two ago. It's a really interesting book. He also, in this book, has the he has a full Momonkan with his commentaries, and the full Hekigan Roku, which is the Blue Cliff Record, 100 koan that we do after the Momonkan, that are somewhat more difficult, more penetrating, but similar. And he has comments on those as well. But this is case number 46 of the 48 koan in the Momonkan. Now, Mumon said he didn't put them in any particular order, but I do think there's a reason for this being later, almost the end of the Mumon Khan, the first book of Khan. So this is case 46, and the way it's translated by Sekida is as follows. The title is Proceed On From the Top of the Pole. Sekiso Osho, he was a Zen master of old, Sekiso Osho asked, it's kind of a rhetorical question, how can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? Another eminent teacher of old said, you who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, with a capital W, you are not yet genuine. Proceed on from the top of the pole and you will show your whole body in the 10 directions. So as I describe these steps, just, you know, this is a totally arbitrary pictorial description of this outer circle surrounding our practice, which is this concentration jodaki, and going to an inner circle, somewhat more inner, of dispassion, this clarity of dispassion, then the very inmost circle of this awareness of being knowing, and entering that profoundly, turning the light of the mind in on itself, knowing, looking in on itself in the most intimate way. And the fourth step is breaking out totally. No circles, breaking out. The world bursts into view. There's no sense of opposition. There's no sense of separation. You look out at things, it's like looking at your own face in a mirror. So this is what this koan is trying to describe here. He said, proceed on from the top of the pole and you will show your whole body in the 10 directions. So Mumon's comment goes like this. If you go on further and turn your body about, if you go on further than the top of this pole and turn your body around, no place is left where you are not the master. But even so, tell me, how will you go on further from the top of a 100-foot pole, huh? This is the challenge of this koan, Mumon, is challenging us. How do you take this step off of this profound samadhi place? Some masters say you have to smash through the bottom of the black lacquer bucket. You have to smash through it. No one can tell you how to do that. Basically, you're dialing up the intensity of the questioning. What is it? Is it? One day, suddenly, it breaks open. You might be walking in the woods and looking at some reeds, and it's just obvious and clear. You just get it. And you realize it was always like that. One person said it's like walking through a mist. You walk through this mist and then all of a sudden you realize you're soaking wet. It's kind of like that at times. So, then there's a verse. And each of these koan has this Mumun's commentary, then Mumun's verse, and here's the verse. He darkens the third eye of insight. Remember what I talked about, this grand round mirror as black as pitch. When you enter this third state of profound inward looking, shining the light of the mind in on itself. He darkens the third eye of insight and clings to the first mark on the scale, which might be clinging to this third step in the way I'm describing it. Even though he may sacrifice his life, he is only a blind man leading the blind. Now this is kind of an ironic Zen way of saying it, and I won't go into that too much. It's like the blind leading the blind. Blindness in Zen is actually quite valued. Blindness is the blindness of not making distinctions. And as you go further, it's the blindness of not seeing. It can be said in Zen, in this fourth step that they're talking about, jumping off the pole, that not seeing is true seeing. Not hearing is true hearing. Not smelling is true smelling. Another word used to describe the state is just flower, just incense, just pain in the knee. Understand? We come from a place where I am in here, the world is out there, the world exists, stands outside. Therefore, I engage in an action called seeing. I see this floor. I, in here, see this floor. But in this state where you jump off the 100-foot pole, after you've gone to the very core of reality and realize that there are no dividing lines, and you jump off that place into, you burst, your body is manifest in the 10 directions, as they call it, then you realize that it's just that seeing is embedded in sights, hearing is embedded in sounds, smelling is embedded in odors. You see that clearly. There's no place for understanding here. It is the world just as it presents. You burst into this state. This is a critical step, this leaping off the top of the 100-foot pole. Now, it can happen dramatically, and people can feel overwhelmed, deeply moved, profoundly liberated. Some people describe it as an earth-shattering experience. This is the enlightenment, the Kensho experience. But it's not always like that. As I said before, sometimes it's like you walk through a mist for a long time, and then you realize you're soaking wet. It just comes into sharp focus one day. The focus has been described as follows. The focus of this stage, this step of taking this leap, leaving behind the small self. They say, I've seen the truth clearer than a diamond in the palm of my hand. That's the way it's described. And it's very, very true when you have this experience. I see it more clearly than I would see a diamond in the palm of my hand. Because still there'd be some separation. Here I am looking at this diamond. There's no need for that anymore. So, we've actually run out of time, and what I'm going to do is the next teisho, I'm going to go into the commentaries of Sekida, the fellow who put together these two collections. And we're going to go deeper into this, because he talks about some of the things that I've mentioned tonight, including the importance of samadhi. So, just to leave you with this, it's very important to get yourself to the top of this 100-foot pole. And it's very important throughout your whole lifetime of practice to keep going back there. Keep re-entering this samadhi state, this deep, pure state. But also come out and manifest your body in the 10 directions. So This is why it's important, I think, to have some guidance in this practice, so that you have a pointer. You have to walk this path yourself. It was very helpful to have friends that point out things so you know the direction to move in, and you save yourself a lot of time and trouble. So we'll end there tonight.